Star Trek Into Darkness is number one at the box office right now, the sequel to the latest reboot by director J.J. Abrams of a cherished 47-year-old franchise.
Spock, nobody knows the rules better than you, but there has got to be an exception.
None. Such action violates the Prime Directive.
Spock, we're talking about your life!
The reboot was controversial when J.J. Abrams, who said outrageously that he never was a fan, released the first installment in 2009. Fans were offended in advance that he had the audacity to cast youngsters to impersonate Kirk and Spock, who could only be Shatner and Nimoy. But they were silenced by the bravura results. Here's The Onion's take.
And with us now to discuss the backlash is entertainment reporter Bree Lindsey.
Hi, Glenn.
Bree, is this Star Trek as riveting as the fans are complaining it is?
Glenn, early reviews are calling it a delightful action-adventure movie and a surefire hit.
No wonder the fans feel betrayed here.
Apparently, there isn't even one scene set at a long table in which interstellar diplomacy is debated in endless detail.
Really?
What made it so fiendishly effective for long-time Trekkers, Trekkie is demeaning, was that its young Spock and Kirk were perfectly cast, and it offered comforting continuity and in-jokes, while at the same time introducing a change in the timeline of the voyages of the Starship Enterprise right at the beginning, so it wouldn't have to stay true to the past. Even more important, both films have stayed true to Star Trek's fundamental principles, as noted in this review on YouTube by Dead Drop SD 1972, who gave it a 10.
It asks you, what would you do? How far would you go? Your ethics, tested to the limits to save your child, your crew, your best friend.
When I first reviewed the impact of the series on its 40th anniversary, I spent a lot of time on it. So here's a shorter version, because, as they say, Star Trek is here, it's dear, so get used to it.
Get a life, will you, people? For crying out loud, it's just a TV show.
When William Shatner said that on Saturday Night Live, though to be fair, he didn't write it, it stung.
I think a lot of fans feel like they are not respected. They're almost ashamed to admit they're fans of Star Trek unless they hear two or three references to Star Trek in the conversation.
Not Barbara Adams. So moved was she by the series' optimistic, pluralistic vision of the future that when serving on the jury in the Whitewater trial 10 years ago, she wore the uniform of a Star Trek officer. If it helps to make people think a little bit more about what those ideals are, then I'll keep wearing this uniform, she said, and then was promptly dismissed for talking to the press. Those ideals were codified by Gene Roddenberry, a former flack with the LAPD who cut his teeth writing Dragnet scripts on spec for Jack Webb. His Enterprise was staffed by a crack, multiracial crew, and though that crew was prohibited by the Prime Directive from interfering in developing societies, Captain James T. Kirk found some way to destroy evildoers wherever he went. Roddenberry allowed us to examine the convulsions of the 60s, racism, the Cold War, and hippies at a distance, mostly through aliens, since he had decreed that there would be no serious conflicts among the crew. But after 3 short seasons, the show died. And for 18 long years, the fans waited as their ranks swelled through reruns and conventions, writing their own episodes and lobbying the network. Henry Jenkins, director of the Comparative Media Studies program at MIT, says that much of that pressure came from an unexpected quarter.
I think if you go back and look at the original letter-writing campaign that kept the series on the air for that third season, which made it viable for a syndication package, the majority of the leaders of that campaign were women. And while the women were disappointed in the ways they were portrayed on Star Trek often, it kept alive this idea that women alongside men would be active participants in shaping the future.
So finally, after an animated series and 4 movies, a new live-action series was launched. And instead of boldly going where no man had gone before, the new captain was to
boldly go where no one has gone before.
We had 3 female cast members on Next Generation.
Executive producer Rick Berman.
One was Counselor Troy, one was the Doctor, and there was some discussion that here we had 2 women in caretaker roles, which seemed a little sexist. But Gene also created this character, Tasha Yar, who was the head of security on board the ship. She was a tough broad and probably the sexiest of the 3.
Berman was hand-picked by Roddenberry to launch the second series, but he's been widely reviled by the fans for coming to the franchise as a newbie and for failing to fully commit to the founder's vision.
If I could sit and corral all the things that have been said over the years, you could put me just a little bit this side of Himmler. Did I see the original series as sacred? No. Did I do my very best to keep from contradicting anything that occurred in those episodes? Absolutely.
The Next Generation also depicted a crew on a voyage of exploration, captained by the resolutely rational Jean-Luc Picard. It lasted 7 years, bookended by a pair of episodes in which an omnipotent being called Q puts humanity on trial.
You will now answer to the charge of being a grievously savage race.
Grievously savage could mean anything. I will answer only specific charges.
Are you certain you want a full disclosure of human ugliness? Present the charges!
It's a squeaker, but guess who wins? In Star Trek, humanity always wins. The sole exception was series number 3, Deep Space Nine, mounted by Berman after Roddenberry's death. Set on a space station in a time of war, humans and aliens were forced to confront crime and corruption within the crew, and the humanity within all these species did not always win.
Will that be all, Commander? I want you to know, I don't personally believe that you are responsible for this.
Really? Now, how can that be true? You don't know me. So don't tell me there isn't some doubt inside of you, some question about whether or not I murdered the man.
Some diehard fans grumbled about the dark nature of the show, but that series also lasted 7 years. The fourth series, Star Trek Voyager, was set on a ship flung to the outer reaches of the galaxy. Its mission was simply to return home, and it also marked a return to the original vision. Only this time, the glass ceiling was broken. Captain Catherine Janeway was at the helm, played by Kate Mulgrew.
I realized that what was at stake was their largest demographic, young men. How was I going to transcend the fact that they could be potentially watching their mother in the chair?
In fact, they watched her for 7 years, even though the bodacious Borg 7 of 9 was added to the crew to boost ratings. But even she represented more than just sex appeal, because in Star Trek, humanity was always the real final frontier, so the best-loved characters were not human. The half-Vulcan Spock in the first series, the android Data in the second, Odo the shapeshifter in the third, and 7 of 9 in the fourth. They showed what it meant to be human by reacting against it, or more often, groping toward it. Here's Data on a date.
This is all part of a program?
Yes, one which I have just created for romantic relationships. I have written a subroutine specifically for you. I have devoted a considerable share of my internal resources to its development.
Data, that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
Later, Data gets an emotion chip, but ultimately rejects it. Spock would approve. He never understood Kirk's infatuation with humanity.
But, Captain, we both know that I am not human.
Spock, you want to know something? Everybody's human.
Find that remark insulting.
I love Spock. He's really awesome.
What's your name?
Emma.
How old are you?
15.
We found Emma at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Northern Connecticut checking out a display of Star Trek memorabilia soon to be auctioned by Christie's. Like thousands of others, Emma writes fan fiction, original stories based on the series, and she posts them on her blog, as do many of her friends.
Most of them write from the original series, Kirk and Spock. They either write Slash or just friendship.
What's Slash?
Slash is the gay romance, and it's very popular all over the web. And I write some of it, but I prefer the friendship.
She says the fans she's met online hated the last series, called Enterprise, set in a time before the original series, and they're very riled up about the new movie, another prequel, which recasts Kirk and Spock as students at Starfleet Academy.
And people say they can't do this to our franchise, and they call it their franchise. I know it's definitely not our franchise, but I think we have a big part in it, because without the fans, there would be no, continuation. There would have been no The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine or Voyager.
Through the fans, Star Trek lives long and prospers in cyberspace, where they create and consume thousands of new stories and hundreds of videos, including new episodes. It's not what Trekkers solemnly regard as Star Trek canon. It's called fanon, a tapestry of new plots and backstories endlessly embroidered by fans. Tim Cavanaugh is the web editor of Reason Magazine.
We grew up really loving Star Trek in the purest possible way. We just loved it as kids. You get to high school, you get to college, suddenly you become this super ironist and you realize how campy it is and over the top. And every joke about Captain Kirk getting it on with green women or about crew members wearing red shirts and dying, they've all been made. To some degree, the show has outlived all of that stuff.
But that may not matter to some fans for whom the show may have actually outlived the show. Erstwhile Whitewater juror Barbara Adams.
I don't think fans should worry about there not being a Star Trek series on. If it's not a good Star Trek series, if it's not showing us what we want to see in Star Trek, we don't have to have it there.
At some point, for fans like Adams, Star Trek shapeshifted from a franchise to a kind of creed, perhaps because Roddenberry made it seem almost plausible, because it made use of some real science and referenced some real history. Or maybe it's because his founding vision was bound up in the belief that ultimately it's our shortcomings, our passion, our restlessness that will save us, that as much as Vulcan logic and detachment are venerated in the Trek world, it's somehow better to be human. Just kidding. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sarah Abdorfman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Ravenna Koenig, Alexandra Hall, and WNYC archivist Andy Lancet. And it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Rick Kwan and Justin Garish. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news, and our boss, bassist-composer Ben Allison, wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week on Brooke Gladstone.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.